Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 10 is brought to you by Bowl and Branch, Audible, and Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that, research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
Have you ever noticed how, in certain cases, the media spends a lot of time discussing the criminal history of not the perpetrator, but the victim? It doesn't happen with all victims, just certain kinds. And it happened to Freddie Gray because, well, he was that kind of victim. I'm sure you get my drift. But here at Undisclosed, we like to go beyond, way beyond the headlines and talking points. So today, we take a closer look at Freddie Gray's criminal record, and also a closer look at the other players in the case, the ones who made it out alive. Officers Goodson, White, Porter, Novak, Miller, Nero, and then, of course, there's Lieutenant Rice, who was supposed to be supervising that day. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, and I'm here with my colleagues, Amelia McDonald-Perry, Justine Barron, and Dr. Marcia Chatlin.
My name is Amelia McDonald-Perry, and I'm a former blog editor and a journalist for RollingStone.com and CrimeFeed.
I'm Marcia Chatlin. I'm an associate professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University, and I'm also an Eric and Wendy Schmidt Fellow at the New America Foundation.
My name is Justine Barron. I'm a screenwriter, researcher, and columnist at the Jewish Journal.
To paraphrase Leo Tolstoy, all happy families are alike, but every dysfunctional police department is messed up in its own way. In his opening statement in the trial of William Porter, defense attorney Gary Proctor described the Baltimore Police Department as broken and ineffective. When Porter attended police academy, he witnessed a gun instructor shoot a trainee in the head by accident. That was Porter's big welcome to BPD. The defense's case was filled with such anecdotes. Patrol officers on the street without evidence bags for storing the drugs they confiscate. Broken computers at the stations. Field training officers who sign off on training that might never have actually been completed. Cops learning about changes in marijuana law from the TV news. And leadership giving the rank and file too many mixed messages. In following one general order, you could have violated three more. Isn't that right? Proctor asked. It was absurd, the defense argued, to expect a young patrol cop to be accountable for big organizational problems. Our sources say the same. They describe cars that break down, forced overtime, and no money for protective gear or partners. Cops ride solo in Baltimore, making their jobs less safe and effective. Police departments across the country face similar issues, but BPD has some specific problems that came to a head around the death of Freddie Gray. From how the department evaluates its officers, to which officers it allows to stay on the streets, despite numerous, very serious warning signs. On the morning of Freddie Gray's arrest, Porter's defense lawyer said that there were supposed to be two wagons, 3 to 4 sergeants, and 15 officers working the district. In fact, he said, there was only one wagon, one sergeant, and 8 officers. Well, there were 9 officers at stop one on the CCTV. Regardless, almost all of the Western District Patrol officers working that morning showed up for stops 1 and 5 to help manage a knife arrest and a small-time drug arrest. That didn't leave many officers, if any, to answer urgent calls. Point being, patrol was understaffed and badly managed. According to the Fraternal Order of Police, there are only about 700 officers doing full-time street patrol work in Baltimore. That equals about one patrol officer for every 880 residents. New York City has about one for every 380, and a much lower murder rate. BPD has struggled to hold on to officers in general, but especially in patrol. Until recently, the most ambitious, talented patrol officers were scooped up by specialized units. This left in patrol only the least experienced officers and those without ambition or apparent skill. And then some officers just really like patrol. Since BPD doesn't have any educational or work requirements beyond a diploma or GED, many patrol officers also lack prior experience in a high-pressure environment, working with diverse groups of people. Only 20% of the force lives inside of Baltimore City. An FOP report shared studies showing a correlation between inexperience and police corruption. On the morning of Freddie Gray's arrest, officers Garrett Miller, Edward Nero, William Porter, and Zachary Novak were working the Baker shift, or B shift, beginning at 7 a.m. By 7:30, they were finished with roll call, which ended with these words, according to Porter in court: "Back each other up." All four of these officers were around 22 years old when they enrolled in the academy, except for Nero. He was 26. He had some relevant experience, having worked as a volunteer firefighter in New Jersey since high school. Novak, Nero, and Miller, who are white, grew up in the suburbs of Baltimore and Philadelphia and have continued to live outside of the city. Porter, who is black, grew up in West Baltimore and has stayed in the city. All four of these officers finished training and were placed in the Western District in 2013, with a starting salary of about $45,000. By the time they started working, zero tolerance was effectively over, in theory. A memo had been issued in 2010 by then Commissioner Bielefeld. It was actually titled No Zero Tolerance Policing, and it halted arrests for quality of life crimes. But policy hasn't exactly confirmed with practice. The distance between police policy and the reality of daily policing on the streets was maybe the largest takeaway from the trials of the officers who were allegedly involved in the death of Freddie Gray.
I'm Detective Thomas Bender, the Baltimore Police Department crash team. I'm here to talk about seatbelt safety as the summer approaches. When you drive in the city of Baltimore, make sure everybody in the car has a seatbelt on. Seatbelts save lives.
How did so many officers neglect to seatbelt Freddie Gray in the van when it's been policy for a while? Maybe in part because an even earlier policy said to always seatbelt prisoners except when placing them in the transport van. We received BPD training manuals with orders that date back to the 1960s. Earlier general orders tend to be short, clear. They tell a story. Quote, "A patrolman on foot has certain advantages," a 1968 order read, and then it had 10 short bullet points outlining rules for foot patrol. Over the years, BPD orders have become kind of like policing itself, bloated, complicated, and technocratic. Batz's revised orders on persons in police custody, which covers seatbelts, included 15 pages of bullet points and sub-bullet points that spelled out every single last permutation of action that an officer might take while a prisoner was in custody, down to handling bathroom breaks. Imagine starting the force and getting hundreds of such orders. You're set up to fail.
Fortunately for officers, day-to-day policing doesn't pay much attention to policy. In an op-ed for the New York Times, Detective Joe Crystal, BPD whistleblower, described a moment in the Department of Justice report when a sergeant told his officer to make something up as a reason to arrest some young men on the corner. The sergeant didn't know this behavior was unconstitutional, Crystal explained. He did it right in front of a DOJ civil rights investigator.
Over the years, BPD commissioners have issued shorter manuals that they hope officers will actually read, like Commissioner Kevin Davis's recent 28 Core Operating Principles. This only proves the point. Policy-based training doesn't work. Baltimore recently signed a consent decree with the Department of Justice Here's hoping that most of these reforms don't just exist on paper. Patrol officers learn how to police from their supervisors, many of whom came of age at a different time and haven't been retrained. Old practices survive because so much of policy exists as if in a cloud of inaccessible bullet points. It's a huge disconnect. Policies that infantilize officers, trusting them with nothing, then practices that give them as much discretion as they want.
Okay, Undisclosed listeners, we know how important facts are to you, so I've got one for you. Science tells us that there are 5 stages of sleep, but before you enter any of them, you need to be comfortable so you can fall asleep. And that's what all the sleeping pills are trying to do for you, make you comfortable, but you don't need all that. Let me tell you what you do need. Bowl and Branch sheets. Folks, Bowl and Branch sent me a set of sheets about a month ago, and they are by far the most comfortable sheets I've ever had in my life. Like, it's life-changing. It's like they were designed for royalty or something. Well, maybe not royalty, but they are soft enough that 3 former U.S. presidents and countless celebrities sleep on Bowl and Branch sheets. Unfortunately, they won't let me say which U.S. presidents, but it's still pretty cool to know that these sheets are so comfortable that they're being used by important people. But here's the thing, they're really not all that expensive. In fact, by the end of this spot, I am going to tell you how you can get a great deal on Bowl and Branch sheets. But first, let me tell you why they're so unique. Each Bowl and Branch sheet is crafted by 100% organic cotton. That means Bowl and Branch sheets not only feel incredible, but they look amazing. And since Bowl and Branch sells exclusively online, you don't pay expensive markup for retail pricing. That's half the price for twice the quality. Try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, return them to Bowl and Branch and they'll give you a full refund. Anyone who sleeps on Bowl and Branch loves their sheets. That's why they get thousands of 5-star reviews. And not just online reviews. The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Forbes magazine rave about how comfortable Bowl and Branch sheets are. So check it out. Here's that offer. Go to bowlandbranch.com today and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets. Plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use our promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's $50 off plus free shipping in the U.S. at bowlandbranch.com. That's spelled B-O-L-L and branch.com. Promo code undisclosed. That's bowlandbranch.com. Promo code undisclosed.
On the morning of Freddie Gray's arrest, officers Miller, Nero, Porter, and Novak reported to Lieutenant Brian Rice, who played a role in training them. Rice joined the force in 1997. From early in his career, Rice was an aggressive officer, making a large number of arrests, mostly for drug possession, drug dealing, and quality of life crimes like loitering. Rice was promoted to sergeant and then lieutenant in 2011. To earn these ranks, officers must wait a few years and then pass a test. Rice's job requirements as lieutenant were to supervise and train, but he chose to do this on the streets. He continued to make regular drug arrests with other officers. As lieutenant, Rice's case files are fascinating. Well, he was on administrative leave a lot, which we'll get to in a bit. Other than that, he was described over and over again as making arrests. He's the one identifying and detaining subjects, handcuffing and booking them. But he was never named as the arresting officer or complainant. He gave that to someone else, whoever did the paperwork, I guess. There are different kinds of lieutenants. Some that are more administrative, and some, like Rice, that find it hard to quit the streets. Baltimore police officers are evaluated based on one index, arrests. They're not evaluated on whether those arrests were prosecuted, resulted in convictions, or reduced crime. This is not the same everywhere. It's not the same in New York City. Retired NYPD detective Joseph Jacalone explains.
Are cops even aware of, well, the cops are, but are the supervisors and departments keeping track of how many arrests are thrown out and how many arrests are possible?
Yes, they do. Yep, in New York City they do. They look at your conviction rates as well as your arrest, because if you make an arrest and it doesn't get prosecuted, that's just as bad as not making the arrest at all. So, yes, they track that. That's something that it gets done and gets talked about at CompStat also. You know, detective squads have to keep track of that stuff.
So that's different in Baltimore. They don't do that in Baltimore.
Well, there's probably a reason why they don't. It's because they're not convicting anybody. I mean, we have five counties in New York City. You know, a lot of people don't realize that. They think New York City is just Manhattan, but we have five counties, five boroughs. You know, the Bronx, we call it the People's Republic of the Bronx, because it is like, if you're going to commit a crime, that's the way you go. They have a 23% conviction rate of anybody who gets arrested in the Bronx, which is the lowest by far of any of the five counties. So if you were tracing back to Baltimore and you started looking into their conviction rates, I think that would be quite alarming. That's just my guess. That's, you know, there's usually a reason why, you know, the officials don't do certain things, and it's usually because the numbers are extremely low. Like, for instance, I would also look at, if you're interested or any of your listeners are interested, I would also look at Baltimore's homicide clearance rate, which I'm pretty sure is abysmal, meaning how many homicides they have versus how many they solve.
Right.
Because you remember, the more people are out there, the more likelihood there's going to be additional homicides.
There has been a lot of discussion about how the bail industry and the for-profit prison system exchange cash for bodies. Arresting is also a profit business in Baltimore. The more arrests an officer makes, the more opportunities for advancement and overtime pay. Baltimore's arrest culture incentivizes unconstitutional stops, planted evidence, and volume over careful, thoughtful policing. Is it hard to believe that this arrest culture could play a role in how terrible crime is in Baltimore? I downloaded the arrest records for the officers in this case. I looked at about a year and a half of data before Freddie Gray's arrest. Officer Miller, who arrested Gray, was the most aggressive of the four patrol cops by far. He was listed as the complainant on 63 arrests during that period, as opposed to 27 for Nero and 40 for Novak and Porter. Like Lieutenant Rice, Miller has a propensity for arresting people for drug possession, especially marijuana, and quality of life crimes. And he likes knives. For Miller and his colleagues, more than half of their arrests were thrown out by the state's attorney's office and never prosecuted. Cops complain about prosecutors throwing out good arrests, but I've read through many of their probable cause statements. Miller has stopped and searched people for yelling at each other, for walking strangely towards a car, for smelling like marijuana. Oh, by the way, every car in Baltimore smells like marijuana. I've read the files. Since BPD evaluates officers based on arrests only, Miller's record might have marked him as a good cop before Freddie Gray's death. He might have been in line for a choice transfer. He might have made detective and been put on one of those squads where he would have faced even fewer limits to his freedom and authority. In court, Miller describes his relationship with Nero. "We did everything together. The two of them," he said, "also had gone out on bike duty with Rice a lot." Even though Baltimore police doesn't have partners, it does have informal partnerships and cliques that show up on a lot of arrests together. This is especially true since Commissioner Batts did away with individual posts and had officers work together in sectors. More than a quarter of Miller's arrests involve Nero and vice versa, and it's mostly just the two of them. They formed a unique pair. Novak was also grouped with Miller and Nero often. Novak was in Nero's police academy class. The relationships extend outside of the workplace. Miller and Nero are good friends. And sometime, in either late 2014 or early 2015, Miller moved into a house in Westminster, Maryland, that is only a few houses down from where Lieutenant Rice lived. There's an almost too easy division in this case. Three white cops who are involved in arresting Freddie Gray together, a fourth if you include Novak, and have a history of collaborating. and three black cops involved in Freddie Gray's transport and checking on him. Porter, Caesar Goodson, the van driver, and Alicia White, the sergeant who checked on Gray at Stop 5. Like Porter, White and Goodson grew up and have lived in Baltimore City. White joined the force in 2010 with a college degree. She had just been made sergeant and was transferred to the Western a few months before Freddie Gray's arrest. White was the only female officer involved in the arrest, and one of only three female officers involved in the entire case and investigation, out of around 30 or so officers total. Only 15% of BPD officers are women, very few in positions of power. In a way, the three officers involved in this case, including White and the two investigators, share a role in common. They're trying to clean up the mess. Caesar Goodson, the van driver, joined the force in 1999 following in the steps of his grandfather, a retired officer. Apparently, Grandpa was also a nickname of Goodson's. One of the first things many, many police sources have told me is that Goodson was not the type of driver to give a rough ride. He was not aggressive. He was just quietly working towards retirement. In fact, although rough rides do happen, most wagon drivers are described as like Goodson, not retaliatory, not that invested at all. Goodson came up around the same time as Rice and worked in the Western. Like Rice, Goodson made a lot of arrests. Unlike Rice, he made very few drug arrests. It's amazing how much of crime enforcement depends on the whims and interests of the officers in one area. Anyway, this isn't about bad white versus good black cops. We've got critiques to go around. But the division can't be overlooked. After the charges were dismissed, the six indicted officers were offered the chance to receive an award at an event hosted by the Media Research Council. MRC is a nonprofit organization that funds angry right-wing websites in need. Only the three white officers accepted the invitation. Miller gave a brief thank you speech. "We're losing cops every day," he said. And then he caught himself. No, not so much from cops being shot, but because, quote, "nobody wants to be a police officer anymore."
Hey folks, it's Dennis, producer of this great program, Undisclosed. I am a huge fan of Audible. Y'all know that. I tear through audiobooks like it was my job. On Audible, I recently finished The Nine by Jeffrey Toobin. I just started The Great Dissenter, a book on Oliver Wendell Holmes. I'm probably going to get through that in the next week. Then I'm thinking I might switch back to some fiction just to break it up a little bit. See, that's one of the coolest things about Audible, of the many cool things about Audible. But it's got such a wide selection that if I want to switch between nonfiction or some sort of legal treatise that's going to benefit me professionally, then to something fictional that is going to entertain me and make those long drives just a little bit shorter, Audible has it all. I love Audible, and we at Undisclosed want you to love Audible too. And for first-time Audible users, here's how you do it. Go to www.audible.com/undisclosed. You're going to get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial. That's www.audible.com/undisclosed. That's www.audible.com/undisclosed. Go there, browse an unmatched selection of audiobooks, and pick one out for yourself as part of that 30-day free trial.
According to the Department of Justice, in 2015, 42% of Baltimore's police force was black, an impressive number when you consider the long fight to hire, promote, and retain black police officers in the city. Those numbers are a direct result of the advocacy of Baltimore's Vanguard Justice Society, established in 1971 when African Americans were few in the city's police departments. While all officers are ostensibly represented by the Fraternal Order of Police, the organization's history of segregating meetings, as well as supporting extreme presidential candidates, led many African Americans in the late 60s and early 70s to form their own small but cohesive organizations to ensure that Black police officers had a voice in their local police communities. The Vanguard Justice Society has a long history of not only speaking up on behalf of Black officers, but also pursuing lawsuits against the Baltimore Police Department around hiring, promotions, formal and informal practices, and have used the courts with varying degrees of success to diversify the police force. The first major Vanguard Society lawsuit was a class action civil rights claim on behalf of approximately 600 people, and with support by the NAACP, attorneys Kenneth L. Johnson and Anthony Robinson filed the case in 1973. They alleged that African Americans were kept out of the police department by discriminatory entrance exams, Black officers served in racially segregated units, and were excluded from promotions to administrative and supervisory roles. And the lawsuit also included practices that targeted Black citizens. The lawsuit claimed that police officers gave traffic tickets to Black drivers at, quote, a significantly higher rate than to white persons. After failed attempts to negotiate an out-of-court agreement, the case went before a judge, but no jury, 5 years later in 1978. At trial, Lieutenant Melvin Freeman, the first African-American assigned to a BPD radio patrol car in 1957, testified that he had taken and passed the sergeant's exam four times before actually receiving a promotion in 1966. He described the protocol for selection as difficult for Black officers to get noticed for advancement. Barnett Q. Brooks, a former officer of 10 years, testified that he joined BPD in 1969 after earning a college degree, and while working as a detective, acquired a master's degree and a law degree. He thought that returning to school would improve his chances to get elevated in the ranks of BPD, but instead he was actually demoted and ordered back to a district patrol position because of budget cuts to headquarters staff. Eventually, the cases concluded with a $6 million settlement to the plaintiffs in the BPD case. Robinson, the Vanguard's attorney, commented, "I think we'll see a different complexion of the Baltimore City Police Department, a department that now does not reflect the community it serves." Not all officers saw the judge's orders to reform Baltimore police as a victory, particularly in the plan to address racial discrimination in testing. U.S. District Court Judge Frank Kaufman ruled that the sergeant's exam administered by BPD between 1972 and 1977 were in fact discriminatory, as was the entrance exam used between 74 and 77. The city determined, as part of the settlement agreement, to administer a non-discriminatory test to be given to Black officers as a remedy for the previous exam, and that those who passed it would be given promotions and retroactively granted seniority privileges. The Vanguard Justice Society saw this as a way of making the victims of prior discrimination whole. The new test was scheduled for late October of 1979. Then, on October 12th, the Fraternal Order of Police filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court to halt the test. The FOP argued that it was unfair to administer another test as to ensure equity, and the FOP legal representative said that the lawsuit was not a Black-white issue. Rather, he advocated for a test that was, quote, fair to everyone, including Italians, Greeks, and other ethnic groups. The Vanguard Justice Society responded that the FOP was merely representing the people who have the benefit of discriminatory policies. The FOP lawsuit failed to block the test, and the new exam led the way for 18 Black officers to enter a pool of potential candidates for promotion. 15 additional Black officers were able to secure sergeant positions after the new test. 4 years later, Robinson was filing new charges against BPD on behalf of the Vanguard Justice Society. In 1983, Robinson delivered what he described as detailed complaints of racism in the BPD to the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC. This filing was made a week before the scheduled hearing in federal court about the initial 1973 case. 10 years since the initial lawsuit, the issue of the promotions was still being litigated in the courts. The EEOC filing was an attempt to tackle what Robinson called lingering vestiges of discrimination. Robinson, speaking for approximately 40 Black BPD officers, reported that the Baltimore Police Department took no action against white police officers who made racist statements in public,
detailed the ways that black officers were harassed for speaking up against racially motivated harassment. They believed that there were different standards of conduct for black and white officers, and that black officers received reprimands for things that white officers did. And finally, that race still determined the quality of officer assignments. A police spokesperson responded to the allegations by assuring that members of the department are assigned as individuals, not as groups, and stated that, "We expect our officers to be colorblind on the street, therefore the department is colorblind with its personnel." After years of collecting anecdotes and crunching numbers, the Vanguard Justice Society had yet to see colorblindness inform their lives inside and outside their local police precincts. Throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, Baltimore witnessed a significant increase in the number of officers of color, and women officers of all backgrounds also benefited from the legal advocacy of the Vanguard Justice Society. The legal struggles of the 1980s and 90s appeared to pay off, as black officers supported and celebrated the appointment of black police commissioners from the very first, Bishop L. Robinson in 1984, to the seventh, Anthony Batts, who was head of the police department when Freddie was killed. Yet balancing the relationship between themselves and the larger police department, City Hall, and the FOP reps could be particularly challenging, so the Vanguard Justice Society remained vigilant in monitoring the culture of BPD for black officers. In 1997, the Vanguard Justice Society again found themselves wondering if they would ever be treated as equal members of the Baltimore Police Department. The group called for the resignation of Commissioner Thomas Frazier, who served between 1994 and 1999. Frazier, who was the first police commissioner from outside Baltimore since 1966, and was the first white commissioner chosen after Baltimore police had been led by three African Americans consecutively, came to Baltimore from San Jose, and he was praised for his commitment to diversity. As was the tradition with the Vanguard Society, Frazier was extended a membership to the group, but 3 years into his leadership, things had changed dramatically. In 1997, the organization's members voted unanimously to revoke Frazier as a member of the society. In addition to the long-held concerns about racism within the department and the slow pace of promotions, the Vanguard alleged that members of their organization were spied on while attending a meeting on racial disparities with the Community Relations Committee. The Vanguard Justice Society also believed that spies were present during a meeting which addressed concerns about Frazier's commitment to end racial problems. Among the attendees was Colonel Ronald Daniel, who was suspended for insubordination shortly after attending the community relations meeting. Daniel's suspension was eventually rescinded and the mayor reinstated him, but news of the tension between the Vanguard Society and the police commissioner again made observers wonder if Baltimore really wanted to change the color of policing after all. In May of 2015, after the six officers were charged in Freddie's death, the Vanguard Justice Society held a news conference about the Baltimore Six, with a special emphasis on Sergeant Alicia White, a Vanguard member who was characterized as a local who attended church in Sandtown and was dragged into a situation much bigger than her. At the press conference, which also featured comments by White's attorneys, the Society's Vice President, Lisa Robinson, captured the two priorities of the Society. In addition to their expression of full support for White and the five other officers, Robinson said that the Society looked forward to a Department of Justice investigation and the opportunity to discuss policies and procedures in terms of hiring, firing, disciplinary actions, as well as promotions and transfers and policing strategies.
Hi, listeners. It's Amelia. Working on this podcast for the last 10 months has been pretty all-consuming. There are many, many days where I'm so immersed in reading case files, doing interviews, writing episodes, and playing gotcha that eating is a total afterthought. My diet has basically consisted of stovetop quesadillas, gallons of grapefruit juice, and peanut butter on toast. Vegetables? I don't know her. The thing is, I love to cook. And more than I love to cook, I love to eat, and I eat everything. But I can't seem to find the time to go to the grocery store. And even when I do, everything is sold in such big portions that most ends up going bad. I just want a carrot. Why do I have to buy a bag of them? You know what? I don't. Because I'm a brand new Blue Apron convert. Guys, I'm obsessed. First of all, the menu options each week are amazing. I loved the lemongrass burgers with carrot slaw so much, I ate them both in one sitting. Just one of the perks of being single. Blue Apron's recipes aren't repeated for at least a year, so your palate is always expanding. I'm looking forward to whipping up this week's tandoori-style chicken and rice. The recipes come on these fancy, durable cards, so you can file away your favorites and cook them whenever you want. The seared chicken and creamy couscous with olive and raisin sauce would be a hit at a dinner party. My dog Luca is a chicken connoisseur, and she gave this recipe two paws up. Right, Lou? I also love that Blue Apron sends you just the ingredients you need so there's no waste. This is great news for me, as my fridge is currently full of month-old leftover takeout, moldy cheese, and a bag of what I think was once kale. It just really needs to be cleaned out. I'm seriously impressed with how perfectly proportioned and fresh all of Blue Apron's ingredients are, and I love that the smaller necessities are called knickknacks. So cute. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Yeah, you look at Freddie Gray's rap sheet, and it's long. Freddie Gray has been arrested, literally dozens of times. And there's an interesting way to look at that. Look at how many times the police did not kill Freddie Gray. I mean, this rap sheet, it's amazing for somebody 24 years of age. And a number of times the cops could have really damaged him, but they didn't for some reason, so why now?
Mr. Gray was a drug-involved person. He was a user and a dealer on the streets. He had 20 arrests with 5 outstanding when he was taken into custody. Is that Mr. Gray's fault that he was a low-level criminal? But I'll tell you one more thing. There are more good people than bad people. But the bad people are overwhelming the good people. And the good people have to put an end to that themselves.
When people of color die in police custody or through use of force, it's exceedingly common to see the victims portrayed as responsible for their own demise because their behavior warranted such treatment or their life choices would have sent them to an early grave regardless. The subtext is that some human life is worth more than others. The longer the rap sheet, the less these deaths matter. To conservative blowhards like Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, both pillars of virtue, obviously, Freddie was a career criminal, a life already wasted. When O'Reilly talked about good people versus bad people, he may have been referring to the looters who turned Baltimore's uprising into riots. But by contemptuously defining Freddie as a drug-involved user, dealer, and low-level criminal, O'Reilly might as well have been saying that Freddie was one of the bad people that the good people had to put an end to. Freddie Gray's arrest history is long, but this says more about the way Baltimore polices neighborhoods like Sandtown and maintains its court records than it does his actual crimes. The vast majority of the charges against him were dropped by prosecutors. Those that stuck cost him plenty. Like many young black men in Baltimore, Freddie's arrest record begins within weeks of his 18th birthday. In late August 2007, he was arrested on 3 separate occasions for drug possession or intent to distribute. In January 2008, Freddie was sentenced to 3 years in jail, but with 2 years, 7 months, and 22 days suspended, or time served. This is a common and tempting plea offer in Baltimore, but it always comes with a condition: probation. The danger in accepting a plea deal like this is that it really kind of benefits police and prosecutors in the long run. Being found guilty of a probation violation basically guarantees jail time, often as much as the original sentence, so the threat makes for a convincing bargaining chip. Dante Allen is proof of that. His willingness to not only take Officer Danny's phone number, but give a statement to quote homicide, it wasn't charitable, it was survival. He had 17 years hanging over his head. That's quite a compelling reason to cooperate with the police. 3 years is a long time to fly under the radar in West Baltimore, especially when the police know who you are and what's at stake. Freddie lasted just over a month before he was arrested for possession of marijuana and cocaine in February 2008. By the time the case was tossed out 6 weeks later, he had been charged in 2 more drug cases. The quick succession of arrests for drugs practically mimicked the trouble Freddie got into at the end of 2007. Only this time, he was guilty of violating his probation. Before he could be sentenced, Freddie was arrested for a 4th time in July 2008. Freddie was held without bail, and he was charged with 2 counts of possession and 2 counts of intent to distribute. Already facing 48 years behind bars, prosecutors upped the ante. They filed a motion to double the possible maximum sentence to 96 years based on his prior conviction in the 2007 case. At minimum, they wanted him to serve 10 years. In January 2009, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for violating his probation. A few months after that, he was sentenced to 4 years to be served concurrently for the July 2008 case. Freddie Gray was not yet 20 years old. Freddie was released from prison in July 2011, having served a little over 2 years. He kept a low profile for about 9 months. Then, on April 13, 2012, officers from BPD's vaguely named Special Enforcement Team showed up at the home of Gloria Darden, Freddie's mother. They were armed with a search warrant and a battering ram, which they used to break down the front door. Freddie wasn't home at the time. According to the Baltimore Division of Corrections, he was already in jail. Spokesman Gerard Shields told CNN that on April 4th, Freddie had committed some sort of minor offense that was in violation of his probation. But we haven't been able to find any record of this particular arrest, and neither has any other media outlet that has tried. A thoroughly researched BuzzFeed News article from August 2015 cites records that corroborate Freddie's incarceration, but there's no indication what it was for. According to the probable cause statement for the raid, Freddie was the target of the investigation. His older sister Carolina, his twin sister Frederica, their stepfather Richard Shipley, and an unrelated man named Michael Edmondson were all arrested and charged for various offenses. Their charges were quickly settled out of court. But it would be another year before Freddie, still locked up for that mysterious early April offense, would have any closure. Freddie was held in custody without bail for over a year, as his hearing was postponed 6 times for various reasons. Finally, on May 20th, 2013, Freddie got his day in court in front of Judge Michael Reed. His defense attorney was brought in by the Office of the Public Defender, whose own staff was unable to represent him because of some undisclosed conflict of interest. Her name was Janice Bledsoe. Yes, that Janice Bledsoe. And Freddie Gray was not a fan. Freddie was adamant that he wanted to take his chances and go to trial, believing that because he wasn't home the morning of the April 13th, 2012 raid, prosecutors wouldn't be able to prove the drugs and paraphernalia were his. But it was a risk. Prosecutors had requested a mandatory minimum sentence and a doubling of the maximum penalties, which meant more than 50 years behind bars, the first 25 without the possibility of parole. Bledsoe had already negotiated a plea offer that was generous in comparison. 14 years suspended, save for time served, plus another year and a half probation. Freddie could go home almost immediately. But standing in court in his orange prison jumpsuit, his sisters watching from the back of the courtroom, Freddie wouldn't budge. Bledsoe openly pressured her client to take the plea deal, her frustration mounting with every passing second. "Do you want to plea or not?" she snapped at one point. Judge Reed asked Bledsoe about whether there was any truth to Freddie's contention that he was incarcerated the morning of the raid on his mother's home. Bledsoe was vague, but said it wasn't a defense she was likely to pursue. I suspect Bledsoe was bluffing, in hopes of pushing Freddie into taking the deal. Still, he refused. Judge Reed also seemed to think it would be extremely ill-advised for Freddie to pass up the state's offer. Quote, "I'm going to send you to trial," Reed warned Freddie before giving him one last bit of advice. "As a judge, what happens is you get this perspective. I handle cases from judges that sat 20 years ago, and what I get are people like you today at your age who are now in their 50s and 60s. I got one guy in his 70s. And what they're trying to do is recreate this day. At a certain point, this offer will not be available to you, and I just want you to know that." At the very last second, Freddie changed his mind. He was willing to plead guilty to the felony charge of possession with intent to manufacture and distribute, but in exchange for 9 years suspended instead of 14. Before making the deal official, Judge Reed asked Freddie if he was satisfied with his legal representation. Freddie said that he thought Bledsoe had done a bad job, but didn't really explain how. Bledsoe was clearly pissed. "Your Honor, do you have any more questions about my representation?" she asked. "No," Judge Reed answered. "I'm satisfied that he is not satisfied with your representation." 2 years later, Janice Bledsoe's responsibility to Freddie Gray was arguably far greater. As the deputy state's attorney in charge of the police integrity unit, she was assigned to be one of the lead prosecutors in the case against the 6 officers charged in Freddie's death. Whether he would be satisfied with her representation is something we'll never know. 4 months after begrudgingly accepting Bledsoe's plea deal, on a Saturday afternoon in late September 2013, a former BPD officer named Joyce Pinnock was monitoring the City Watch cameras in the Penn North area. According to the probable cause report, Officer Pinnock alerted dispatch that 2 men were engaged in a drug transaction, while a 3rd man, later identified as Freddie Gray, acted as a lookout.
Officers Jerome Charette, Keegan Mills, and James Briscoe responded to the scene and arrested Freddie and his companion, Kamonta Johnson. After debriefing them at the Western District Station, the officers were preparing to take Johnson down to central booking when he broke free from his plastic flexicuffs, shoved open the transport van's doors, and made a run for it. He didn't make it very far before being apprehended. Freddie didn't participate in this little getaway attempt. Presumably, he was still inside the station and was later transported to central booking alone. The probable cause statement is almost entirely about Johnson. No drugs were found on Freddie, and he was never even seen engaging in any sort of drug exchange. The only suggestion of his involvement in criminal activity is the City Watch cop's description of him standing at a busy intersection, looking back and forth, quote, acting as a lookout. Nevertheless, Freddie was charged with four drug offenses. Johnson was charged separately, and neither was listed as a co-defendant in the district court records. This is exactly the type of weak or utterly bogus drug case that prosecutors usually drop. But instead, 2 days after Freddie was granted bail, the Division of Probation and Parole wrote Judge Michael Reed a letter recommending that he issue a violation of probation warrant for Freddie's arrest and that Freddie be held without bail. The letter claimed that this most recent case was part of their Violence Prevention Initiative, or VPI, a program targeting the most violent repeat offenders. Not only were the September 2013 charges for nonviolent offenses, but Freddie had never been charged with a violent offense, period. Not a single weapons charge or even resisting arrest either. But 1 month later, Judge Reed issued the warrant, and Freddie was served and arrested. The next day, Freddie's case was merged with Johnson's and forwarded to the circuit court. Freddie was held in custody for a month before his private defense attorney successfully argued for his release. But the charges stuck, and they weren't resolved for almost another year. Between November 2013 and August 2014, Freddie and Johnson's trial was postponed 3 times. During that same time period, Johnson, who was held without bail, was listed as a witness in a Housing Authority eviction case against a Gilmore Homes resident named Audrey Williams. She and Johnson shared the same Bruce Court apartment address, though their relationship was unclear. The officers who arrested Freddie and Johnson were also listed as witnesses in the Housing Authority case, as was Johnson's probation officer. Based on the documents in the case file, it's clear that the Housing Authority was using Johnson's arrests and his status as an unauthorized occupant of the Bruce Court apartment to argue that Audrey Williams was in breach of her lease. In addition to the September 2013 case, the Housing Authority also listed 2 prior cases in which Johnson was charged with assault and weapons possession. So Kamonta Johnson was the repeat violent offender, not Freddie. There's really only one explanation for how, then, the parole board ended up sending Judge Reed that letter, advocating for Freddie to be arrested and held without bail. The Housing Authority wanted to have him in custody to use as a witness, and knew holding him in custody would be the only guarantee he would show up. Had they been successful, Freddie would have been jailed for months on bogus drug charges for the sole purpose of evicting a woman from her home. Thanks to the parole board, the Housing Authority, and their thirst to evict someone, Freddie was considered a violent repeat offender by the Baltimore police and the state's attorney's office, despite never having been arrested, charged, or convicted of a single violent crime. The charging documents in 3 other cases between 2014 and 2015 have VPI scrawled at the top. I haven't heard back from the Housing Authority as of this taping, but I did receive an email from Gerard Shields of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services explaining how Freddie Gray might have ended up on the VPI watch list. Quote, "Not every person on VPI supervision has committed a violent crime," he wrote. "All are in the VPI after careful investigation using risk assessments such as background investigations, past prison record, and intelligence information gathered." The screening criteria for VPI did at one point include those with current felony drug charges, but that did not seem to be the case at the point when Freddie was added to the list. According to a June 2013 fact sheet, only current charges for assault or gun-related crimes were considered an element for VPI inclusion. It's possible that Freddie's arrest and sentencing history were superseding factors, but the timing of the parole board's letter and the obvious connection between the drug case and the Housing Authority eviction case are just too coincidental to deny. By the way, Audrey Williams was eventually evicted from her apartment in the summer of 2014. 2 weeks later, in late August, Kamonta Johnson accepted a plea agreement and was sentenced to 3 years in prison for the whole getaway attempt, plus probation. On that same date, prosecutors also decided not to pursue the charges against Freddie. Imagine that. There was one incident in which Freddie was accused of violence, but it was the month before his death. a friend of the Gray family, who I'll refer to as John, filed for an arrest warrant alleging malicious destruction of property and second-degree assault. He said that he was giving Freddie and his sister a ride late one night when Freddie became angry and kicked his car window, breaking the glass. During the altercation, John wrote in the complaint, Freddie hit him in the face. I gave John a call to verify his account was legit and to get a few more details. He said that he didn't call the police, but some cops nearby saw the argument and approached. Weirdly enough, though, the police shrugged their shoulders and declined to do anything. They told John that he would have to go down to the court commissioner's office himself to file a complaint. He did, and a summons was issued, but Freddie died before their scheduled court date. John expressed sadness about Freddie's death, saying he had never had any trouble with him before and was completely caught off guard by his behavior that night. At trial, Officer William Porter told a story about how Freddie had been arrested just 2 weeks before April 12th, also in the vicinity of Gilmore Homes, for, quote, attempting to kick out the windows of an SUV. Porter said he responded as backup and named another officer who was present. But I can find no record of this arrest under Freddie's name or any of the various misspellings police have used over the years. If Porter was referring to the citizen complaint filed by John, well, he got every detail but the broken window wrong. John's car was not an SUV. The incident occurred in mid-March and was a 5 to 10 minute drive from Gilmore Homes. The police weren't called, and when they did meander over to see what the fuss was about, they offered no assistance. Porter also testified that when Freddie was arrested, he would, quote, usually act out and yell and feign some type of injury. We've reviewed the probable cause statements and charging documents in every single one of Freddie's cases and can find no evidence of Porter's claims. If Porter is telling the truth, then that means his fellow officers had ignored Freddie's request for medical attention on multiple occasions prior to April 12th. Had a medic been called for Freddie at any point, it would have been noted in the police reports. Unfortunately, prosecutor Michael Schatzow never even questioned Porter's characterization of Freddie's prior behavior. Not only was this a missed opportunity to call into question the veracity of Porter's testimony, but this account, BS or not, very clearly underscores the cavalier attitude Baltimore police have towards prisoners who complain that they've been injured. You know, the basis of the state's entire case.
Understand Freddie Gray's arrest history in a broader context. I did a comparison of arrest data in two neighborhoods. I looked at Sandtown, Winchester, and Penn North in West Baltimore, the scene of his arrests. And then I looked at the area around Johns Hopkins University, my alma mater, a few miles to the northeast. Hopkins undergraduates live off campus for 2 to 3 years, most in their own apartments in the Charles Village neighborhood. There are very few CCTV cameras surveying this area. Looking at arrests of 18 to 22-year-olds, so undergraduate age, for the last 3 years, there were 21 arrests for illegal drug possession in the Charles Village area. 9 of these were for marijuana. All but 2 of those arrested were Black. Hopkins' undergraduate population is only about 7% Black. It follows that Hopkins students aren't being arrested for drug possession much. In Sandtown, Penn North, there were around 900 arrests for drug possession. About 150 were for marijuana. Arrests for most other crimes in these two areas have the same imbalanced ratio. It follows that Hopkins students are not being arrested as much as their counterparts in West Baltimore. Well, duh, you might be thinking. But the question is, are Hopkins students actually committing that many fewer crimes? A feature story in the Baltimore City Paper in 2015 compiled several years of sexual assault incidents reported at Johns Hopkins that had led to a crisis in the community's Greek life. One fraternity, known as Pike House, had already been suspended in 2014, not for the alleged gang rape that happened at one of their parties, but after one of its brothers got stabbed. That suspension cited underage drinking, the provision of alcohol to minors, unsafe behavior, failure to comply with university and police directives, and disturbances of neighbors. Sure, some members of Greek organizations are of legal drinking age, but Maryland Code 10117 makes the knowing provision of alcohol to minors a misdemeanor offense. There are these online forums where you can find out about the different Greek houses at Hopkins, including which ones are known for sharing marijuana or cocaine. While a couple of forums do mention police breaking up parties sometimes, what nobody talks about in any of these articles or forums are Hopkins undergraduates getting arrested. It's happened, probably. It's clearly not common, though, which is interesting, given the criminal behavior being described in a city notorious for rounding up young men on corners for minor offenses and drug possession. Neighborhoods that are more heavily surveyed by police presence reflect increased arrests and so increased crime data, obscuring the truth about behavior. Stop and frisk doesn't happen in Charles Village, but 39% of college students report using an illicit drug in the previous year. About 5% report using marijuana daily. A federal study showed higher usages and even dealing of all different types of drugs among whites than blacks, besides crack cocaine. There's one exception to this imbalanced pattern of arrests. Since January 2013, 17 individuals of all ages were arrested for rape in the area around Hopkins, most of them south of Charles Village. In Sandtown, Penn North, only one documented rape charge in more than 3 years. Only three in the entire Western District. In an area with such an enormous police presence, it's surprising to see how a crime that is reported to have happened to anywhere from 1 in 10 to 1 in 5 women, a violent crime no less, is barely enforced. It may be barely reported, but the DOJ report on policing of Baltimore found that BPD, quote, seriously and systematically underinvestigates reports of sexual assaults, including among vulnerable populations, like sex workers. Meanwhile, there are no shortage of arrests for prostitution. Actually, this isn't surprising, given how violence against women occurs and is handled within police ranks, behind the blue wall of silence. On April 12, 2015, Lieutenant Rice went on bike patrol with Miller and Nero. Believe it or not, this is one of the biggest mysteries in the case. Rice was not just a lieutenant, he was the shift commander, also known as the lieutenant in charge, also known as O-9 on the radio. As one of our most treasured sources, a retired commander, put it, "Why the fuck is the O-9 shift commander on a bike?" He repeated this loudly, and then he said, "You're responsible for the whole district. What if someone gets shot? To me," he added, "it sounds like he was fucking up." A former patrol lieutenant also emailed me about this. Quote, "It's strange for a lieutenant to ride a bike. The one in charge of the Inner Harbor rides a bike. I would be surprised if any other lieutenant would ride a bike at all." It's even weirder, he wrote, for Rice to have made this choice on a Sunday morning. That is the quietest time in police work. Officers would be washing the police cars, having the equipment inspected by the sergeants. The lieutenant would be reviewing the inspection reports. It is very unusual for a lieutenant to be leading drug rips anytime, especially on a Sunday morning. Note, Lieutenant Rice led drug rips all the time. In a dozen case files from 2014, Rice is described as on foot or bike patrol, scoping out drug dealers, stopping and frisking, canvassing for evidence, and then he'd have one of his officers write the report and take the stat. I couldn't find any pattern that might indicate behavior more suspicious. Maybe Rice is just a hands-on, generous supervisor. Maybe. That's not what our sources think. Rice's role as a supervisor during the arrest of Freddie Gray was underplayed during the trials and also in media. Although Rice seems to strategically avoid the camera during key moments, there are signs throughout of him behaving aggressively. In the longer version of Kevin Moore's video of Stop One, Rice chases bystanders away after Freddie is loaded into the van. He rides through them on his bike, yelling, "All right, you're gonna leave the area immediately or you're gonna be arrested. Off the streets or you're going in the car." When somebody says, "We live right here," Rice responds, "One more warning or you'll come with us." At Stop Two, as Freddie lay limp outside the van, Brandon Ross is heard on a cell phone video crying out, "Hey, Porter, can we get a supervisor in here, please?" Porter gestured towards Rice. Then Brandon said, "Can we get somebody else up in here, please? It ain't cool, man," he repeats in distress. And then Porter says, "Brandon, you know where he goes at," and tells him to take the video to media. Ross told the Baltimore Sun that Rice pointed his taser at him then. Porter actually wrote up one of Rice's arrests. In a kind of shady report, he describes Rice getting really angry and arresting someone for tossing a cigarette butt on the ground. That's what you get for letting other people write up your arrests. Rice never appeared on the stand during the trials, either to defend himself or as a witness for other officers. There's a very good reason for that. Rice had a history. On April 21st, 2015, 2 days after Freddie Gray's arrest, The Guardian printed its first of 7 articles breaking the story of Lieutenant Rice's troubling and recent past. The stories uncovered 7 years of alleged harassment, stalking, and threatening of Rice's ex-girlfriend, the mother of his child, and her then-husband, among other problems. Rice's ex is also a BPD officer. I'm choosing to omit her name on purpose. On January 24th in 2013, her then-husband filed a complaint with the Carroll County Sheriff's Department. Over 10 pages, he outlined a long, sustained campaign by Rice against his then-wife and him. I've read the report. It's available online. It sounds convincing. For a couple of reasons, though, I don't consider the writer to be entirely credible. But we don't need him. Law enforcement got involved on several occasions and wrote their own damning reports. In April 2012, Rice's ex requested that police check on him, following a suicidal outcry. He, quote, could not continue to go on like this. The sheriff had Rice's service weapon and 6 other personal firearms confiscated. Rice was emergency petitioned, sent to a hospital for mental health surveillance. The sheriff's deputy spoke to one of the Western District supervisors, concerned. The supervisor requested that the deputies not fax over their report. Instead, he would send someone to pick up a copy with Rice's service weapon. Well, this sounds like an effort to shield the truth from the higher-ups. Still, Rice was placed on administrative suspension. Based on his arrest records, he appears to have returned to work in July 2012, a few months later. And yet, during his leave, Rice had another big incident. In June, Rice's ex and her family returned from a road trip, claiming to find Rice waiting for them, drunk, at 2:15 a.m. 2 Carroll County officers, Timothy Fabus and Nicole Enser, arrived and wrote up separate reports of the incident. Rice refused to reveal his identity, but they figured it out by running his plates. Enser described trying to talk to Rice's ex, but Rice intimidating her and disallowing it. Rice eventually left, and the officers spent several hours making sure that he was okay, tracking him down, seeing if they could get him a ride. It sounds like they were worried about drunk driving, maybe, or suicidality. As throughout, the account of Rice's ex and her husband is actually much worse. The incidents continued. The following January in 2013, Rice called the police and told them to go to his ex's house and investigate what he considered to be a violation of an order between them. The husband wasn't allowed to supervise Rice's son alone. Officers arrived and left, satisfied that there was no issue. Later that night, at 2:16 a.m., Rice went to the court commissioner to file criminal charges against the husband, and he made his status as a BPD lieutenant known loudly. The new husband was actually arrested, but eventually acquitted. The judge described Rice's behavior as serious and wrongful. Rice was placed on leave again in February, I think related to this incident. His guns were confiscated. This time, Rice appears to have been suspended for most of 2013, until October. Gene Ryan, Fraternal Order of Police president, issued a statement supporting Rice. He was, dealing with a domestic issue. It had, quote, nothing to do with his ability to perform his duties as a BP officer. Ryan knew this, he said. He'd worked with Rice. Quote, I would be very surprised if he did something like that, he said. Ongoing battles between Rice and his arch-rival continued until Rice had a major outburst just 2 weeks before Freddie Gray's arrest on March 29th. At 3:45 a.m., apparently Rice's witching hour, he arrived at the Westminster police station demanding that his nemesis be arrested, this time for violating a protection order filed by their now shared ex. Rice showed them a copy of the order. It had nothing to do with them. In his report, the sheriff quoted Rice saying, "Heads will roll if something happens to her or the children if you do not go arrest him." Rice again wouldn't give his real name or number, only saying that he was a BPD lieutenant. Sergeant Nicole Enser once again wrote up her own version of the incident. She made a point to add that she contacted the supervisor at BPD and then finally heard back from Internal Affairs. So up until Freddie Gray was arrested, Rice was being investigated. We have wondered why Rice was allowed to be on the streets on the day of Freddie Gray's arrest. The quote from the FOP president suggests a lot about how police view Rice's troubles as relationship issues, not indicators of any greater problems. It's as if uncontrollable anger, frequent late-night outbursts, childish temper tantrums with other officers of the law can be contained in a box called girl problems. We've also wondered why the investigators into Freddie Gray's death focused so little on Rice's conduct before and after the 12th. Maybe for everyone to have taken stock of Rice's out-of-control behavior, they would have had to deal with having protected him for years, possibly even opening up investigations into his closed cases. This is just a hunch. It also seems like Rice had some friends in high places.
Now spent 10 weeks examining in close detail everything that happened or could have possibly happened on April 12, 2015. Stop by stop, we've painstakingly deconstructed the official narrative. We've looked at eyewitness accounts, police statements, and evidence such as the alleged knife, the blood in the van, and the CCTV footage. There is, however, one vital piece of evidence that didn't exist and could not have come into existence for another 5 days. Until April 19th, 2015, the day that Freddie Gray died. And that evidence is his autopsy. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 10, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald-Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, and Rabia Chowdhury co-wrote this episode. Methyl Telhan produced and Saad Chowdhury consulted. We also want to make sure we give credit to Margaret Hugh, Lane Keniston, and Melissa Liddick. All of them took a lot of time to pull case files for us, so thanks so much to Margaret, Lane, and Melissa. We appreciate each of you more than any words I say in these credits could possibly express. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Our great sponsors this week include Bowl and Branch, Audible, and Blue Apron. Hey, don't forget, with Audible, you've got an unmatched selection of audiobooks to include magazines, business journals, pretty much everything that you could want in audio. Go there now for a 30-day free trial and one free audiobook by using www.audible.com/undisclosed. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce this show for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring T. Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow D on Twitter at DWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray and or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins. Until then,